You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter is the latest figure to weigh in on the continuing scandal over the Bush administration's use of faulty intelligence to justify its preemptive war against Iraq. He shared these thoughts in a recent press conference hosted by Sonny Miller, executive director of the Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts.
By standing before the American people during the State of the Union address and telling them that Iraq posed a threat to the security of the United States because it was seeking to restart a nuclear weapons program, and that part of the evidence used to sustain this are intelligence from Great Britain that shows that Iraq was trying to procure uranium from Niger. He lied. Now, this isn't a matter of him saying, you know, I thought it was true at the time. We now know that everybody in the intelligence community knew this to be false. We know that the vice president's office sent somebody to Africa to investigate, and that finding was sent back to the vice president. The president lied. Now, a government official lying in the conduct of carrying out the responsibilities of his office, that's fraud. And fraud, under federal statutes, is a felony. And felony is a perfect definition of high crime and misdemeanor. So the president has committed an impeachable offense. Now, are we going to impeach the president? I don't know at this point in time. Not when you have a Republican-dominated Senate, not when you have a Republican-dominated Congress, not when you have a media that is as culpable as our elected representatives in sustaining the mythology of the Iraqi threat in the lead-up to the war. Remember, it's the media is to blame as much as anybody else for feeding the lies that the government told to the American public. The media never once stood up and questioned the president and his administration in a meaningful fashion in the buildup to this war. So the media is culpable. So don't wait for the media to do the right thing. Ultimately, we got to go back on what America is about. You know, that Constitution we all speak about so proudly begins, "We the people of the United States of America." And the Supreme Court has found in looking at the Constitution that it is the people's Constitution. It is a document of the people. The people have to hold the president accountable if we are to sustain the reality that we are a democratic republic. There must be an accounting. If we can't impeach the president, and I believe that he has committed an impeachable offense, one greater in terms of the scope and scale of what he's done than anything Bill Clinton ever did. But if we can't impeach the president, then we darn sure can make sure that he doesn't have the honor and privilege of representing the people of the United States of America after November 2004, and he can be voted out of office. Either way, the lie that this man and his administration has told must be explained to the American people. They must know the truth, and they must, by being exposed to the truth, be given the opportunity to act on the truth. And the plain fact is the president told a whopper, not just about the uranium in Africa, but about every aspect. Donald Rumsfeld just came out, he's Secretary of Defense, just came out and said, we didn't have any new intelligence on Iraq. He's all but admitted. The British intelligence, the British Defense Department has come out and said the same thing. We don't have anything new about Iraq that dates after 1995, 1996. What he said is, what we've done is in post-September 11, we have reevaluated this information, this old information, through a new prism of reality, which is what? What reality? That Al-Qaeda attacked the United States? What link is there between Iraq and Al-Qaeda? None whatsoever. It hasn't been sustained. What's the other prism of reality? That September 11th was used by the Bush administration to facilitate implementation of a national security strategy of global hegemony, global domination. That's the reality. So we now have the Secretary of Defense all but admitting that he lied to the American people, because he's the one who said he knows, he has bulletproof evidence that Iraq had these weapons. And yet now he's saying, no, well, that evidence wasn't really that bulletproof. It dates back to 1995. We're just looking at it through a new prism. But the new prism is a very politically charged prism that has nothing to do with the legitimate national security interests of the United States of America or any real threat posed to the security of the United States of America, and everything to do with implementing a neoconservative agenda of American domination of the world.
And I'm afraid that involves great economic benefit as well. I'd like to ask a follow-up question on behalf of Judith at The Advocate in North Adams. She asks, in what way can people effectively communicate their concern about unnecessary wars and the incredible pace of new arms manufacture that's going on?
I mean, the best way is at the election, at the election booth. But you need to understand that if you wait until November, when you step into that booth, you're going to be given a range of options that you may not have any control over. So take control of the democratic process now. Select who you want to represent you. Make sure that when you step into the election booth, that there's a name up there that you believe in, that you support. Democracy is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year job. It's not something that happens once, on election day. Democracy is a full-time job. Be a citizen, not a consumer. A citizen is somebody who is actively engaged in their community, whether it be a local community, a county community, a state community, or the national community, or the global community. But be a citizen. Educate yourself. Educate others. It's a full-time job, but no one said democracy is going to be easy. If you don't want to participate in democracy, understand this: others will. And what happens when you have a great majority of Americans withdraw from the democratic process? You no longer have democracy. You have an oligarchy where power is concentrated in the hands of a few. And that, sadly, is what we have in America today. We have a power elite that stepped into the vacuum created by the apathy of the general American populace. Look at how many Americans participate in the election process. How many people went out and actually pulled a lever last election? 36-37% of eligible voters or registered voters? That's not democracy. Okay, and the people that did vote, that the results aren't reflective of, the overall population's input. What you get now is a heavy influence of corporate funding, corporate money, corporations' money by the candidates, unions' money by the candidates, special interests by the candidate. That's oligarchy. And when you combine oligarchy with what's happening in the post 9/11 America, you get a slide towards fascism. And that's a rough word to use. But what is fascism? I mean, Benito Mussolini, the father of fascism, said that fascism is about rejection of pacifism. Well, look at what the Bush administration and the neocons have done. They've attacked the peace movement. They've attacked anybody who proposes an alternative other than war. Why? Because according to proponents of fascism, the only way that a nation shows its virility as a nation is through war and the warlike spirit. And a fascist government is a confluence of corporate interests and national interests, which are concentrated in the hands of a few, an oligarchy, who put in place perpetual warfare. And that's what we have right now, perpetual warfare. We're at war everywhere. We have a war on terror. We have a Homeland Security Department that has, a national mood ring that the president and his advisors can up and lower whenever they want to. I mean, they don't even have to explain why they're doing it. We're at yellow, we're at orange, we're at red. We can go any direction. The people don't know what's going on. They're just told to be afraid. Why do they want them fearful? Because fear combined with ignorance creates an environment in which the president can sell the lies he has already sold to the American people and the lies he's going to sell to the American people down the road. Four words the American people need to familiarize themselves with: democracy, republic, oligarchy, fascism. We're supposed to live in a democratic republic. We don't. We live in an oligarchy, and we're sliding towards fascism. So what can the people do? Reinvigorate the concept of representative government. Make sure that you get the right people in office. Make sure that you participate in the electoral process. Make sure that when you put somebody in office, you hold him or her accountable for what they do in your name.
Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter speaking at a recent press conference with Sonny Miller, Executive Director of the Trap Rock Peace Center in Western Massachusetts. Last Sunday, Koreans celebrated the 50th anniversary of their armistice, which brought the Korean War to an end. To commemorate this anniversary, Peace Watch is running a 5-part series this week on the current political climate in Korea from our reporters Aaron Glantz and Nok Win, who are currently in Seoul, South Korea. Today we hear from Kim Gwintae, a member of the National Assembly of the Republic of Korea, a senior ranking official within the country's Millennium Democratic Party. He is a leading politician on the left and was the party's presidential hopeful in the last election. Kim Gwintae was formerly a pro-democracy leader and has been imprisoned for that work. He received the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award in 1987 along with his wife. Gwen Tay recently sat down with Peace Watch correspondent Nak Rin to discuss the current nuclear crisis and the possibilities for peace on the Korean Peninsula, growing opposition to U.S. militarism in South Korea, and the legacy of American involvement in Korea.
The Pentagon recently said that it would not rule out war if negotiations between the United States and North Korea fail. What role can South Korea play in ensuring the crisis is resolved peacefully?
한국과 미국은 동맹국입니다. 우리는
Korea wants the United States as a strong ally in the present, future, and into the 21st century. To achieve peace on the Korean Peninsula, the opinions of the South Korean government and the people must be the primary concern. We respect the opinions of the United States when it comes to what is good for their country and citizens. But in this matter, we want direct control of our own destiny. We want our own will to be respected by our allies. However, some Bush administration officials have not done so. This is what has invited harsh criticism on the part of the South Korean people.
The deaths of the two young schoolgirls last year seem to be a turning point in the relationship between the U.S. military and South Korea. The two soldiers driving the tank that crushed the two young girls were never punished. People were outraged. The one-year anniversary of the incident recently brought out tens of thousands of protesters against U.S. troop presence in Seoul. What's your response to the anti-U.S. military sentiment that seems to be growing in South Korea?
I believe that perception has been misconstrued. I know that CNN broadcasted banners during the protest that said, "We do not serve the U.S. Army." But they exaggerated the real situation. We condemn the United States, President Bush, and the military commanders who refused to take responsibility for the death of the two girls and for showing arrogance by not apologizing for the actions of the military. And some hawks under the Bush administration tried to undermine our efforts to promote the Sunshine Policy of engagement with North Korea, and that has also angered South Koreans. But I believe that sentiment is not representative of every Korean. The Bush administration and the South Korean government have been maintaining a close and cooperative relationship. The U.S. helped us achieve democracy, market economy, and prosperity. When the South Koreans were suffering under the military dictatorship, they helped our country democratize. They must help us promote peace proactively with North Korea.
The deaths of the schoolgirls made a huge impression on the young South Koreans, who are more likely to view the U.S. military presence in South Korea as oppressive rather than protective. As the young people grow up and become the country's future leaders, what does that mean for the future of the U.S. involvement in Korea?
Young people live with passion. If they compromise when they are faced with arrogance, we don't have hope for the future. But as they fight against such arrogance, they will also grow old and begin to comprehend how the world works. And they will recognize the grave importance of keeping ties with the U.S. and promoting the common interests of the two countries in East Asia. We share common values, democracy, human rights, and market economy. What we are witnessing these days is the throes of birth, giving birth to a new and equal relationship between the two countries.
How do you interpret the recent news of the U.S. military's plans to withdraw troops and redeploy them south of Seoul?
We believe that it is in keeping with the U.S. military behavior all over the world. The U.S. has failed to explain why they are moving troops to southern Seoul. I feel uncomfortable with the strategy of the U.S. government because I get the sense that it is designed to tame the South Korean government in a way that promotes the Bush government's interests. I don't like such a move because it gives me the sense that they're preparing to launch a preemptive attack against North Korea. The South Korean people have a right to know why the U.S. troops are moving. We believe the U.S. should have sought the consent of the South Korean people. My sense is that they are trying to put pressure on North Korea. The U.S. troops are here to preserve peace. not undermine it.
Korean politician Kim Gwin-tae speaking with Peace Watch correspondent Nak Win. Hundreds of people converged here in the nation's capital last weekend for an historic four-day series of events commemorating the anniversary of the Korean Armistice and calling for peace and reunification of North and South Korea. In panel discussions, cultural performances, and political rallies, Koreans and their supporters spoke of the region's history of war and the people's desire for a peaceful future. Hyung Lee and Hae Young-yoon, both from CAAAV, the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence and the Chinatown Justice Project in New York, described their personal experiences with war, popular resistance, and immigration at Saturday's rally, which attracted some 500 people to the Ellipse in Washington, D.C.
Gang!
Gang!
While the slaughter ceased 5 years ago, the absurdity of the Cold War has continued. The Korean people were promised freedom and independence in due course by the great powers. Yet we remain enslaved by division and occupation. Despite our cry for a united and secure homeland, peace has not materialized. Who is responsible for these broken promises? The responsibility lies squarely with the United States government. All the way from the Roosevelt administration in the 1940s to the current Bush administration. As with previous administrations, President Bush has advanced a hostile and confrontational policy on the Korean Peninsula by refusing the Korean people's demand for a non-aggression pact and a peace treaty, and by avoiding talks with North Korea to peacefully resolve the so-called nuclear crisis. We oppose U.S. policy towards Korea because it deprives us of the right to live peacefully and suppresses our right to self-determination, not only for Korean people, but for people of color in other parts of Asia, Africa, Latin America, and elsewhere. Unless people of conscience rise up and oppose him, Bush's war policy will bring about destruction and terrorism on the people of the third world. It is a death sentence, and it must not be allowed to continue. It must end now. In the name of 70 million Koreans and billions of people around the world, we emphatically denounce President Bush's act of mass destruction against our right to self-determination. It is the U.S. government that bears the legal obligation to end the Korean War. It is the U.S. government's obligation to abolish a foreign policy that victimizes the people of the third world. We demand that the U.S. government cease evading its obligations and start the peace process immediately. We want peace now. What do we want?
Peace!
When do we want it?
Now!
We should not see a non-aggression pact as a concession to blackmail, as some conservatives would have us believe, but rather the fulfillment of an obligation written into the armistice agreement signed in 1953 and the agreed framework signed in 1994. Conversely, a non-aggression pact is not a magnanimous act of the American government. Self-determination is a basic foundation for democracy and social justice. Without self-determination, the people will perish. We demand that the U.S. government establish a new foreign policy that respects the rights of self-determination of all people. People of the third world, unite. People of conscience, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. The people, united, will never be defeated.
The people, united, will never be defeated.
Korean activists Hyung Lee and Hae Young-yoon speaking at a rally last weekend here in the nation's capital. Thanks to Reem Kadhuda of Pacifica Station WPFW for production assistance with that piece. Beatings, imprisonment, torture, rape. According to a new report by Human Rights Watch, these are the punishments favored by Afghanistan's warlords and factional leaders for anyone who dares to challenge their power. Even more notable, HRW says, is the fact that much of the support for these local leaders comes from the U.S. government, as well as Pakistani and Iranian governmental agencies. Those countries, it says, have done much to entrench the warlords responsible for the worst abuses. Dr. Zahir Wahab has just returned from Afghanistan, where he spent nearly a year advising the Minister of Education as Afghanistan attempts to rebuild its infrastructure following the U.S.-led invasion of 2001. Andrew Stelzer from KBOO Community Radio spoke to Dr. Wahab about his work and what the people of Afghanistan are going through as the U.S. continues to occupy their country.
Dismal. Education is at least, I would say, 60, 70 years behind. Right now, there are some 36,000 students attending 16 institutions of higher learning throughout the country. About one in seven would be women. And there are about 1,700 faculty teaching. Only about 4% of the faculty have doctorate degrees, and these were obtained a long time ago, 25 years ago. Campuses have been destroyed, libraries, laboratories, dorms, classrooms, office buildings have been completely destroyed and looted or degraded severely. And these people have had no opportunity to advance their own learning in their fields or learn about modern pedagogy. It's very primitive, I should say, but also the country doesn't have much money. The entire Ministry of Higher Education will have a budget of $28 million for this year, for the whole country. And that's not enough at all when the needs are tremendous. And so higher education is in a very sad state right now.
What kind of presence do the American forces have in everyday life?
There are 11,000 American forces, apart from the civilians. And you do see American planes, American helicopters, American soldiers all over the place. And there has been heavy bombing in many parts of the country, and the depleted uranium is one residue of this. But also, Americans still, they go search and destroy or search and arrest. Most people don't like the Americans now, I will have to say that. And that's why the Americans really are not safe. The Americans there would tell you that people are just waiting for the Americans to leave and so that the civil war can restart. I mean, I think initially some people were happy that the Americans and the coalition forces came and dislodged the Taliban, because that meant certain kinds of freedoms and so forth for city people, at least anyway. But now there is a feeling that the Americans are there to stay. And it's no more seen as a liberation, but it's seen as an occupation. And then Americans have made a lot of mistakes. You know, they have killed a lot of innocent people. The estimates are that some 10,000 Afghans have been killed, really, since November 2001. At this point, other than some city people and members of the government, of course, and some Afghans who work for the Americans, the rest of the population don't like the Americans. One, because they're now viewed as an occupying force, and two, they continue to insult people. I mean, they search women, they barge into homes in the middle of the night and mosques, they throw their weight around, they bomb the wrong kind of people sometimes. In fact, at one point a couple of months ago, there were rumors being floated that if you kill an American or an Afghan American, you get $2,000 or $2,500 reward.
In trying to assess the situation in Iraq right now and in the future, what can we learn from the U.S.-led war on Afghanistan?
It's the same thing in Afghanistan, except it happened there 19 months ago. You would think, actually, that Washington would have learned some lessons from the Afghanistan failure, in that the attack was overdone, it was overkill. The justification was dubious, because I know for a fact that the Taliban tried at the very last minutes, even a few minutes before the bombing began in Afghanistan. The Taliban ambassador in Islamabad, Zarif, I think was his name, telephoned Zalmay Khalilzad, the Afghan-American special envoy to Afghanistan, to say, let's see if we can avoid a war. And he told them, in essence, too late. So massive death and destruction taking place in Afghanistan. And then there were all these promises, you know, but nothing has been delivered so far. I mean, imagine Kabul, the capital of 3 million people, and has no regular water, electricity, garbage collection, sewer system, not even a single traffic light. So Iraq looks like it's going to be the same story. And in Afghanistan, there are attacks now. People are so disillusioned, so angry, so frustrated that daily there are attacks, not just on the U.S. and U.N. forces, but also on all foreigners now, even on aid workers. And not just foreigners, but also even on Afghans who work with these foreigners. The same thing is happening in Iraq. But also some people would say, look, it's the United States, a Christian Western country, going after two Muslim countries. And people would say the war was about oil and resources and not about terrorism. And people now say, as you know, the Taliban and the Qaeda and other opposition forces are regrouping. They have not been eliminated in Afghanistan. Will the opposition in Iraq be eliminated? I don't know. We will have to see.
As Americans, what can we do to help?
What we can and what we must do is put pressure on Washington not to attack, intervene, occupy, kill people unilaterally, work through the United Nations, but also to now rebuild Afghanistan and not abandon it. We need to put pressure on government to fulfill its promises to Afghanistan, for one thing, but also to be a force for peace, for justice, for democracy, for balanced development, and not be a force of occupation. But also we need to pressure the government that spending $2 billion a month in Afghanistan and $4 billion in Iraq, that's $6 billion a month. That is a lot of money for a country where we close schools here, you know, where we are having a serious fiscal crisis in the United States, but also for people to assert their citizenship, their rights, you know, and not be intimidated by Washington. I mean, what happened to civil liberties, to our own rights, our freedom of speech, of assembly, of thought? So that's what Americans need to do. Pressure the government, you know, to deliver on its promises in Afghanistan quickly, to provide law and order, stability, security, social services, ethnic reconciliation and ethnic justice. Otherwise, it will have to be there for a very long time, because I can assure you, unless there's quick change, massive change in Afghanistan, the day the foreigners leave, that's the day when the civil war would resume.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T. from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA and Sonny Miller. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.